call the meeting to order here. Good morning. Fairly brief. I'm sure somebody's had a chance to take a good look at them.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the minutes.
Thank you. We'll move the approval of the minutes. Any discussion? None. All in favor of the minutes from our January 16th meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. And this morning we have presentations, we've got a number of presenters. And I don't know if the order I have is the correct order, but from the University of Minnesota regarding chronic wasting disease. And I have Dr. Trevor Ames, Pamela Skinner, Davis Seeley, Jerry Torreson, Jeremy Sheepers, close on that one. Okay, thank you. And Peter Larson.
I'm Trevor Ames.
Okay, thank you, Dean. If you want to go ahead and start it off, and we're going to hear a lot of testimony from y'all, and if you're okay with it, we'll take questions as they come up, if that's okay. Don't want to interrupt too much, but I think that's just as easy as any other methodology. So,
okay.
So please proceed.
Thank you. Chair Purcell, members of the committee, I'm Trevor Ames, Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with a report on what's going on with chronic wasting disease at the College of Veterinary Medicine, and what our faculty are involved with. Over the last year, different parts of the university have been contacted by a number of legislators requesting our involvement in finding a solution. CWD represents a significant threat to our wild and farmed cervidae populations, and I'm here with several University of Minnesota faculty and researchers to discuss our work on chronic wasting disease and the new technology that may be used to deal with this problem. While I'm proud of our great faculty that we have at the College of Veterinary Medicine, one of our competitive advantages is collaborating across a large comprehensive university that spans all disciplines like what we have at the University of Minnesota. And we've taken advantage of some of that expertise to propose what we will hear today. Okay. So just a little background. Chronic wasting disease is a progressive fatal disease that affects the brain, spinal cord, and many other tissues in farmed and free-ranging deer, elk, moose, and other cervidae. The disease has been around for over 50 years and is present in a number of countries besides the United States. Chronic wasting disease, or CWD, belongs to a family of diseases called prion diseases, or transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, or TSEs for short. And other TSEs that you've heard about are mad cow disease, scrapie in sheep and goats, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, and then variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which was the human form of mad cow disease. To date, there's no strong evidence of the occurrence of CWD in people, and it is not known if people can get infected with CWD prions. Some experimental studies have shown that CWD prions or proteins can infect primates, raising concern. And since 1997, the World Health Organization has recommended that it's important to keep the agents of known prion disease from entering the human food chain. Scientists believe that CWD proteins or prions are likely spread between animals through body fluids like saliva, feces, blood, urine, and this may either be in direct contact or it may be contamination of soil, food, and water in the environment. And just to be clear, CWD does not appear to have to be naturally capable of infecting cattle or other domestic animals. So if we talk a little bit about what does CWD look like, CWD may have an incubation period of over a year, so the time from when they're infected to when they start showing clinical signs. And obvious neurologic signs may develop slowly. Deer, elk, reindeer, moose with CWD may not show signs of the disease for years after they become infected. And the signs that they exhibit include this drastic weight loss or wasting, stumbling, lack of coordination, listlessness, drooling, and then other symptoms that we would call neurologic symptoms. As of August 1st, 2018, there were 226 counties in 23 states with reported chronic wasting disease in free-ranging cervids. This map is based on information from multiple sources, including statewide wildlife agencies and also the United States Geographical Survey. The map, as stated, is from last August, and so these maps will be brought up to date when the data from the fall surveillance programs is completed. In the last 3 years, the Minnesota DNR has identified 35 wild deer that were positive for CWD. Yep.
Dr. Ames, we have a question, please.
Yep.
Representative Dr. Fink. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we kind of sped past it, but I'm wondering if we can go back a slide or two, and I'm wondering if you could share a little bit with the committee about how a prion disease is different from how we typically think of diseases as far as, you know, a virus or a bacteria, and how, you know, the zoonotic impacts may be different in a prion disease as opposed to other types of diseases.
Chair Purcell, committee members, I'll answer it briefly. We'll probably talk about that a little bit more with some of the follow-up presenters, but basically a bacteria can replicate in what's called a cell-free environment. A virus can replicate, but is dependent upon cells for that replication. And these proteins or prions are capable and are an infectious compound that is capable of causing other proteins to replicate the structure of the prion protein. So maybe if you think of like a crystal, where you can form one crystal and then the other crystals form in association with it. So you'll get better answers from our researchers that work on that.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
So I was talking about the surveillance done by our Minnesota DNR, having identified 35 wild deer that are positive for chronic wasting disease. And I'd also point out, if you look at the map and look at Wisconsin, I'd like to highlight that those infected counties in Wisconsin have all occurred since the early 2000s, so a pretty dramatic occurrence in Wisconsin. And our Minnesota DNR and Board of Animal Health work jointly to monitor and control chronic wasting disease in farmed and wild cervidae. So the faculty that are with us today will give you more information on the service work and research that we're conducting on chronic wasting disease at our college, and the surveillance programs that we have, and possibly a new tool that could help us with the control of this disease. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Torreson. Thank you.
Chair Purcell and representatives, my name is Jerry Torreson. I am the director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab at the University of Minnesota. The VDL, as we are called, is part of the College of Veterinary Medicine, but it's also the official lab for the State Board of Animal Health. I'm going to highlight some of the practical collaborative work the college and the VDL are engaged in related to CWD. So first, each year, a group of veterinary students and CFAN students work with the DNR to assist in sample collection from hunter-harvested deer stations for CWD testing. Not all the days are as sunny and warm as the pictures shown, but it's a good experience for the students and helpful for the DNR and the hunters. Over the last 16 years, over 64,000 samples have been collected by the students with this program. Secondly, we have collaborated with the DNR, the Board of Animal Health, and Cervid Farmers on some applied research to understand the biology of chronic wasting disease better. And so a research element is part of what we do. And most importantly, we at the VDL provide diagnostic testing for CWD for farm cervids through the Board of Animal Health and for deer hunters who choose to test their deer individually. In a moment, Dr. Sheffers will describe the immunohistochemistry test we perform. I also want to mention another test, the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, or ELISA, that is performed at Colorado State University for the DNR. This is a test we performed at the VDL until a few years ago. Frankly, it requires a high number of samples to bring down the cost per test. Colorado has a lot of CWD, and the state subsidizes the testing there so they can provide the test for a fee at below our costs. So we discontinued our ELISA testing, but continued to provide confirmatory testing for samples tested by ELISA. We at the VDL are fortunate to collaborate with all the different stakeholders to work towards solving the challenges posed by CWD. We appreciate your interest in our work, and now Dr. Sheffers will get into more detail on some of the testing that we do.
If I may, real quick, question. Can you just share what this ELISA, the cost of one of those?
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the cost that the Colorado State Diagnostic Lab charges is, I believe, $17, and then there's shipping on top of that.
Well, it's not too outrageous then. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
I'm sorry, but I had a question too. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Torreson, you talked about some cooperation with the Cervid Farms. Can you describe that for me, please?
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. So as the official lab for the State Board of Animal Health and through the program that is administered through the Board of Animal Health by which all of the dead or harvested deer from farm cervids are required to be tested for CWD. And so we do all of that testing at the lab through the immunohistochemistry test that Dr. Sheffers will be describing.
Please proceed.
Chairman Purcell, representatives of the committee, my name is Dr. Jeremy Sheffers. I'm a veterinary pathologist at the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and I'm going to just briefly describe what we do, specifically the immunohistochemistry test. Just to follow up on a previous question about the cost of the ELISA test, it is $17 at Colorado State. Our break even would have been $25, so over thousands of samples, that's a real number to consider for people's budgets, just to give you some comparison. I've got a few slides, some brain anatomy pictures. The first slide we're looking at is the image of a brain, looking at it from the top down. This is a cow brain, but it would be no different from a deer or an elk. The second slide I have is the same brain with the cerebellum removed to expose the brain stem. The third slide I'm going to show is a close-up of the brainstem. Within the brainstem, there's a portion called the obex, and that is the portion of the brain that I need to examine to confirm whether or not a cervid has CWD. So just appreciate the location, the complexity, and the invasiveness of testing an animal for CWD. Normally, CWD prion proteins accumulate in the brain. Their accumulation causes clear spaces, so the lesion that we're looking at on this microscopic picture of the brain, the clear circular spaces are not normal. It gives the brain a spongy appearance, which lends to the name in cattle, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. So accumulation of the prion protein clearly has negative impacts on brain function. The immunohistochemistry test takes a portion of the brain stem. It also takes lymph node. I did not have pictures of lymph node, but keep in mind that lymph node from the head, above the throat, and below the brain, the retropharyngeal lymph node, are also tested. So this picture on the left is a glass slide of formalin-fixed brain and two portions of lymph node, and those are subjected to special staining procedures, which flags the misfolded protein red. So everything you see on the right side, the right picture, is all misfolded prion protein. You can't really appreciate the spongy appearance because of the process, but everything that's staining red is CWD prion protein. So the challenges that I've seen, I've worked at the diagnostic lab for 20 years now, and I've watched the slow march of CWD across North America. We like the IHC test because it is very accurate, but it is expensive, anywhere from $30 to $80, depending on shipping and help collecting samples. It is slow. It's 14 days is the average turnaround time, sometimes longer. It is invasive. It involves collection of brainstem and lymph nodes that can only happen on a dead animal. It's highly technical and challenging. Depending on how you count the steps, there's between 35 and 40 steps just to get to the glass slide and interpretation. But it is the gold standard test that we have. Our future needs, we need, in order to attempt and control the spread of CWD, I believe we need an affordable test that is much quicker, that is non-invasive, that can be done on live animals. It's simple, it's user-friendly, potentially has the ability to be done in the field and not in St. Paul or in Colorado or in Madison or in other states. And it can potentially also be done on environmental samples to get a feel for where we can detect in the environment.
We have a question, if you will.
Sure.
Representative Beckerford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just want to clarify on the slide on that we're on right now. So these would be the future needs of agriculture since we're testing live animals. Just wanted to clarify because I'm not sure how that would work. In the wild, how would we test live deer? If you could just talk a little bit about that.
Right. So there's clearly a challenge in it of testing wildlife. Live wildlife is clearly a challenge. But wildlife leave things behind. Feces, for example. I think about bucks that are in rut and leaving velvet on trees, potentially testing the environment. It is clearly a challenge to sample live animals and release them. There's been many instances where that has not worked well. But there are things left behind by deer that has the potential to be tested.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, please.
But the primary use would be in the context of captive deer.
Right. If we get a test that is better, faster, cheaper, yes, it would have much more value in farm deer and elk, which there is clearly a need for that. So yeah, you're exactly right. It would have much more impact on farmed animals.
Representative Beckerfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you said you earlier the testifier talked about being contacted by lots of different legislators. I'm wondering if has industry also reached out with the willingness to be part of paying for this?
There's been many comments about on the farm side. The complaints that I get are turnaround time, and why does it take so long? And I'm taking a farm deer for slaughter today, and I can't do anything with it for 10 to 14 days. So I get a lot of complaints about the turnaround time. As far as paying for it, there's a lot of complaining already about the board picks up the testing fee, but they're complaining about collecting it, shipping it, and that. So briefly, budgets are tight on the farm side.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. A couple more questions, Dr. Schaefer. Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question on is there any other research going on throughout the United States or even the world? And I would point to, obviously, USDA, they've got a Wildlife Services veterinary focus where they look at wildlife, and I don't remember where that facility is located, but they have been known to do some reasonable research. And then, of course, we've got Ames, Iowa, and some other, if you're in the livestock business, understand the high level of involvement on domestic livestock. But are we the only ones looking at this, or looking at the research out there? Are we lone rangers, or can we look for some help on this?
Chairman Purcell and committee, there's lots and lots of people looking at this. I'm going to let some of the other speakers expand on what has been done currently on the research side of it. There's a lot of people looking at it. You'll hear more about that from the other speakers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need a little context here. How many farmed deer are there in Minnesota right now?
Last time I checked, I realized the board's here. They could give you a precise answer. I believe it's around 5,000 to 6,000 farmed deer on 300 to 400 farms. The numbers have gone down. Farms have gone down. They're in a slight decline.
So if I divide the cost that you're asking for by the number of deer, I'll figure out what this is going to cost per deer, right?
Every farm deer and elk is tested when it dies. Everyone, when they die, they are tested for CWD at the cost of $25 per sample, plus any additional ancillary cost.
Okay, so it's the potential is for 5,000 deer.
That's just the farm deer, and if this can be applied to wild deer, that number is a lot bigger. There's 1 million wild white-tailed deer in Minnesota. 200,000 of those are harvested. So okay. That's a great context question. Those numbers are a little fuzzy.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I can just add to Dr. Shepherd's comments, this isn't intended, and Dr. Larson will be commenting on this more at the end. It's not intended as a solely applied test for farm survey. If we have a portable platform that is rapid and inexpensive that can be used out in the field, conceivably people who want to have their deer tested, or if there are control areas where it's required to have the testing done, it could be applied out in the field on the hunter-harvested wild deer as well. And so really that's part of the ambition, is to make it something that doesn't require people having to hang their deer and reefer vans and wait for the results and not be able to kind of move on with the hunt. The intent of this is to address, yes, the farm survey needs, as well as the hunter-harvested deer as part of this plan.
My apologies. Would you please identify yourself for the record? I forgot to ask you that.
My name is Jerry Torreson. Yes.
Thank you. A couple more questions here. Representative Heinten.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, first I'd just like to tell the university how grateful I am that you guys are looking closely at this specific issue. I know the line of questioning has been around the cost and potential impact to cervid farms, but I remember it wasn't that long ago walking up to my Gander Mountain in Brainerd, Minnesota, and seeing a sportsman vote yes for a legacy amendment that now collects over $600 million over the course of the biennium. And I guarantee my colleagues on the other side over here that if you ask the average hunter, would it be worth $2 million, $5 million, folks want to be able to find some solutions. And if the university has potentially research that they could conduct that would have an impact on identifying this disease, whether the animal's dead or whether the animal's alive, I know hunters across the state of Minnesota would say that's a good investment. I know that folks would be very interested in producing that, irregardless of whether it impacted cervid farms positively or negatively. They want to find some solutions, and I'm glad to hear this presentation.
Thank you. Representative Payton.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification. Looking at the tests and so forth, obviously the lymph nodes are a lot easier to get at than the brainstem. Is the lymph node test, in your opinion, 100% accurate, or do you have to go to the brainstem? That's for either of the testifiers.
The ELISA test, $17 at Colorado State, four-day turnaround time versus IHC, their accuracies mirror each other. In addition to the point of clarification is that lymph node can't be harvested until the animal is dead. It is easier to collect, but it's a post-mortem sample.
Thank you, Chair. Can you tell me what sort of success other researchers have had in live tests on other prion diseases?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to defer that to some of the experts that we have following us that are actively engaged in that research, if that's okay.
Thank you. Please, whoever's going to be coming up when we get to that point, we'll identify that question again.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
And the committee, the next presenter is Dr. Pam Skinner. I'll let her introduce herself and talk about some of her credentials.
Thank you both.
Chairman Purcell and representatives, I'm Pam Skinner. Thank you for taking the time to meet with us today. As a lifelong resident of Minnesota, it is very special experiencing for the first time the inner workings of our state's government. I really appreciate seeing the thoughtful discussions being offered and heard today addressing concerns of the spread of chronic waste disease in Minnesota. So I'm a professor of pathobiology, and I have for the last 16 years been directing an HIV and prion disease research program at the University of Minnesota within the College of Veterinary Medicine. My prion disease research program has focused on understanding the mechanisms underlying prion disease and using this information to develop therapies to treat prion disease and to develop means to diagnose prion disease in live animals. So I've developed a therapeutic product to treat prion diseases, and this product has shown great success in an animal model. The mechanisms underlying this treatment method may hold promise for not only treating prion diseases, but also other related neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's diseases. As Dr. Selig will allude to in his, we thought he was going to go first, knowledge gleaned from prion disease research, including chronic wasting disease, can be often be the foundation for greater understanding of related neurodegenerative diseases. In addition to developing a treatment for prion diseases, I have also developed a strategy for a product to detect prion infection early in the disease process in live animals. And this strategy is based on prion disease-specific biomarkers. So chronic wasting disease-specific biomarkers can be used for the early detection of chronic wasting disease. The development of this product can likely be done rather quickly and in a two-year time frame. The development of this product is part of our present funding request. Again, thank you for meeting with us today.
Thank you. And Representative Claflin, did you get your question answered yet? Or at this sounds like maybe the person to ask.
I would like to know some more details about the success of identifying prion diseases in other animals, what the live testing.
Then I'm going to defer this to Dr. Davis Selig, who's an expert.
Thank you.
All right. Well, so please proceed, and then we'll follow up with questions.
Great. Thank you to the committee. Thank you, committee Chairman Purcell and committee members. My name is Davis Seelig. So to address your specific question regarding previous and ongoing success rates in prion testing. The short version is it's getting better. As Dr. Sheffers mentioned, the vast majority of all of the validated testing that currently occurs for the diagnosis of prion disease is based upon the collection of tissues from deceased animals. There is no validated approach for the antemortem, the pre-death diagnosis of prion diseases. There are a number of researchers, including myself and others Peter will present after me, are engage in the process of trying to refine and develop antemortem tests. There are groups around the country that are working on these tests. The proposals that we put forth are to some degree rooted in seeking to improve upon that testing strategy. So there are some successes in the field, particularly in CWD and in some other prion diseases that Dr. Ames mentioned, scrapie being the largest of those diseases. So there are successes, but right now those successes are still the validated successes are still at the level of the postmortem test, where many people are still trying to develop an optimized, sensitive antemortem test that can capture infected animals very early in their disease.
Okay. All right. Please proceed with your...
Thank you, Chairman Purcell, members of the committee. So thank you for affording myself and us the opportunity to meet with you this morning. So I am a PhD-trained, board-certified veterinary pathologist at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. I have been engaged in chronic wasting disease and prion disease research since the start of my PhD training at Colorado State University in 2005. My PhD work and the subsequent work that has followed has focused on prion biology and chronic wasting disease progression. This work has included the creation and validation of a number of non-deer mouse models of prion disease, including chronic wasting disease. Through that work, we have mapped the spread of CWD prions throughout the body systems of infected animals and looked at the accumulation of prions in the biological excreta that we are talking about today, so urine, feces, and saliva, and then looking at testing modalities to identify prions in those excreta. Since my appointment at the University of Minnesota in 2012, my prion research have continued in the area of modern model development and in work examining the events that contribute to the unique ability of a protein to cause a clinical disease, which is in stark contrast to a virus or a bacteria. And I can touch on your question at the end as well. From my work, and it takes a village, and from subsequent studies that have occurred both around and after my work, there are two noteworthy findings that I would like to bring to the committee's attention. First, detectable prion shedding in CWD infected animals begins as early as 3 months post-infection and persists throughout the entire course of the disease. This allows naturally infected animals the potential to shed infectious prions for 12 months to 2 years, which is the approximate natural lifespan of a prion-infected deer. Second, infectious prions persist in the environment for at least 3 years, and very likely longer than that. There is work in non-CWD prion systems, scrapie being the largest one, where prions have been detectable in the environment for 12 to 15 years after experimental inoculation of the environment. Based on these effects, on these facts, any effective CWD management strategy depends upon the development of a non-invasive, rapid, cost-effective, and sensitive test that can identify infected animals early in the course of their disease. In my 15 years of CWD research, I have had direct contact with many of the prion testing methods that we have and potentially will be talking about today. Specifically, this includes studies examining the feasibility of testing urine, feces, and saliva for the presence of CWD prions, using the diagnostic platform upon which our proposal is based. And lastly, it's important to acknowledge that this testing platform has the very real potential to impact human medicine as well. That is the technology we will be working with, owing to the biological similarities between CWD, prion diseases, and other human neurodegenerative diseases, as Dr. Skinner mentioned, Alzheimer's, Huntington's, and Parkinson's diseases. The test that we are working on could very well be the foundation for a scientifically similar, yet minimally invasive test for these human neurodegenerative diseases. Early work in this area, which directly arose from prion testing, has been very promising. As such, by positioning ourselves as leader in CWD testing, our impact has the potential to be foundational in efforts to develop diagnostic tests for prion and non-prion diseases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had kind of a burning question, Doctor, and you sound like the kind of guy who might be able to ask the question. So I'm looking at a .org known as CWD Info, and I see something here, and a constituent brought this up, and I couldn't answer the question, and you might be the person to do it. So what I'm reading here is that infectious agents of CWD are neither bacteria nor viruses, but are hypothesized to be these prions. Why would they say hypothesized?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Representative. So from the perspective of the scientific community that studies diseases, so as a scientist, it is very challenging for many of us to say something is the direct cause of something else. We are often very skeptical even of our own results. I would say that the vast weight of the evidence suggests that these are diseases associated with misfolded proteins rather than a traditional infectious agent, which is a bacteria or a virus. To date, all of the testing, all of the investigative methods, and all of the 60-plus years of scientific research have ruled out any other causative agent for prion diseases other than a misfolded protein. So I, as a scientist, I respect the word hypothesis. I think from my perspective, working in diseases, in which reflects the perspective of the prion biology research community, there is no doubt that these are caused by misfolded proteins.
Appreciate that. Thank
you, Chair. Doctor, I'd just follow up on that a little bit. As a science guy myself, the hypothesis has been tested numerous times and shown to be a prion.
Correct, yes. So okay. Thank you, Robert. Yes, absolutely. So we have done, myself included, we have done a number of infectivity studies looking at materials that have been treated in a way that would destroy any other pathogenic agent, including a virus, including a bacteria. So pre-treating potential inoculum with these aggressive methods and then inoculating animals with those materials, they develop prion diseases, leaving behind protein is the cause, misfolded protein is the
cause. And I just would offer, Representative Heintman, that some of those websites, whoever's putting those words on paper or on the screen, they may not have that understanding of what science is. We test hypotheses. So it's a tested hypothesis. That would be perhaps accurate, but it's been found to be the prion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would very much like to know one way or the other before spending a lot of money, so that's why I asked the question.
No, I appreciate that, and I'm trying to help out in answering that question. And we scientists come up with hypotheses, and we test them. And this one's been tested numerous times. And so we're... You know, what's the percentage you would say in science? We're 95% certain that we are dealing with prions?
I would say we're 99% plus percent certain.
And in science, we never say 100% because, I'll say I believe in gravity 100%, okay? I think that's been tested enough over the centuries. But there's some things that are new like this, relatively new. So, but that's a good question. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that point, because there's been recently more media attention of a null hypothesis from Louisiana or Texas on that this is not a prion, that this is a bacterium, and I'd like you to address that directly because it's, the thought of vaccination, the thought of having a traditional bacteria and providing vaccines for this, that tool is not there, my understanding. But I'd like you to address that specific study or theory on the record.
Sure. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, members of the committee. So I'll answer that in two parts, I guess. The first part is that So the first part is that the work to date that has been performed, from my perspective and the perspective of the vast, vast majority of the prion research community, fundamentally rules out any other cause other than a misfolded protein. Having met with, and I will use the term fringe, having met with fringe researchers who have presented data to suggest an alternate hypothesis for the induction and progression of these diseases. Having evaluated that data, it is weak, to say the least. I'm happy to discuss the data with anyone here. It is based on some fairly shoddy imaging studies that are sort of like staring at the sky with the naked eye and pretending that you're using the Hubble telescope. So the resolution on their data is not particularly good.
Dr. Schlieke, just let me interrupt.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have these alternative hypotheses been presented in peer review literature?
So, excellent point. So to date, there is no robust peer review study that have confirmed these findings. Thanks. They have been presented at a number of scientific meetings and have been met with less than positive feedback, less than supportive feedback, I would say.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I want to go back to the first point you made about the 3 months. I just need to understand that better. Would you just help us out by being a little more?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Representative, for the question. Thank you, members of the committee. So the vast majority of what we know about the shedding, the natural biology of prion infection and prion shedding, when does that start? How severe does it happen? What levels of prions are shed? How are they shed? Some of the transmissibility experiments that Dr. Sheffers mentioned earlier. Those are based on largely upon experimental studies in which known CWD-negative deer are inoculated with CWD via one of multiple routes, and then those animals are simply followed over time. Excreta is collected. That excreta is tested. Tissues are collected. Those tissues are tested. With conventional and evolving diagnostics, one of which is one of the diagnostics we are interested in working with and improving. And so we know from peer-reviewed studies that following inoculation of infectious prions via the oral route, which is presumed to be the natural route by which deer acquire CWD, with a biologically relevant dose, we know that using testing, a testing platform that we're interested in developing at the University of Minnesota and improving upon, we know that infectious prions can be detected in the feces of those animals at 3 months post-inoculation. This is two points, I think, important to that. One, this is well in advance of them, of these deer demonstrating any of the clinical signs associated with chronic wasting disease, and those animals would then live for, in the wild, and it's speculative, somewhere between another 12 to 24 months or so. So a long period of prion shedding is possible from a CWD-infected animal.
Representative Wagenius.
Yes, you actually got to the point I was thinking about. So they can be infected, mm-hmm. and at 3 months after the infection, mm-hmm. then they can be shedding mm-hmm. what can affect other deer.
Correct. That is absolutely correct.
And that can be 12 months to 18 months that they can be running around mm-hmm. with that.
Correct. That is correct.
Thank you. And I'm going to, well, did you have more, Representative Wagenius?
Well, let's just hold it for there and I'll be thinking about that.
Thank you. I'm going to endeavor to get all of our presenters in front of us here and so we can hear it all. Dr. Schilly, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And now we're to Dr. Larson.
Thank you. Chair Purcell and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Peter Larson, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Veterinary and Biomedical Sciences at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm a new faculty member. I joined the university this past summer and was hired as part of the Agricultural Research, Education, Extension, and Technology Transfer Program, the AgREIT Initiative. I'm a biologist, and my research program is highly interdisciplinary. In brief, I leverage emerging genomic technologies to investigate challenging biological questions. My projects have focused on primate genome structure, vector-borne disease surveillance, and on the origin of sporadic Alzheimer's disease. In order to solve the riddle of chronic waste and disease, we must combine decades of important CWD research with fresh and innovative research directions. We must leverage cutting-edge technologies to accelerate the development of new tools that can be used to combat the spread of CWD. How can we do this? How can we best confront this emerging pathogen that is now spreading throughout the upper Midwest and Minnesota? This is an incredibly challenging question, and it is one that lacks a simple answer. However, we strongly believe that a critical component to managing any emerging pathogen is surveillance. We must have the ability to rapidly determine the presence or absence of CWD prions within a given sample. Deer hunters should have the option of learning whether or not their harvest is positive or negative for CWD within minutes or hours, not 3 to 4 days or longer. Those that manage deer populations should have the ability to test for CWD in whatever sample they would like to test, be it biological or environmental. They should not be limited to tissues extracted from euthanized deer. This is why we are before you today. This past August, we held a think tank meeting that focused on the grim state of current CWD diagnostics. The current diagnostic procedures are expensive. They can take days or weeks to complete, and they almost exclusively require tissues from dead animals. In short, these cumbersome diagnostic procedures have hampered the implementation of rapid and effective CWD management strategies. Our think tank meeting resulted in two critically important insights that have great potential to change the current state of CWD diagnostics. First, we have identified biomarkers that might allow us to predict CWD infections in live animals. This research has discovered distinct physiological changes that occur during active prion infection. Such information can be leveraged using advanced genomic technologies to screen for CWD infections in live deer. Second, we believe that we can design a device capable of rapidly detecting CWD prions in a variety of samples. We believe that we can use modern molecular biology techniques to isolate CWD prions from a given sample, place those prions within a microfluidic environment, and confirm the presence of the CWD prions within a matter of minutes or hours. This next generation diagnostic tool could be used to determine presence or absence of CWD in samples ranging from saliva and mucus to feces or soil. Ultimately, our goal is to manufacture a portable, cost-effective device that can be used to rapidly screen for CWD prions under field conditions. The idea for this next-generation diagnostic test is rooted in recent and remarkable advancements in the areas of nanotechnology, microfluidics, and emerging genomic technologies. Similar diagnostic tools are being developed for a range of neurodegenerative conditions that involve protein misfolding events similar to those associated with CWD, and these include Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. In light of these insights, we have assembled a strong, multidisciplinary team consisting of Dr. Skinner, Selig, Schaefer's, myself, and Dr. Sang-Young Oh. Dr. Oh is a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Minnesota, and his research focuses on the engineering of microfluidic devices. Together, we are prepared to develop the next generation diagnostic tools for rapid chronic waste and disease surveillance. We anticipate that deploying these tools to the front lines of the CWD battlefield, whether that be in Minnesota or neighboring states where infected animals are more common, would result in a real-time assessment of the CWD landscape. Such data would facilitate informed management decisions, ease concerns of consuming CWD meat, and could ultimately slow or prevent the expansion of CWD. I thank you for your time, and we are happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned bodily fluids. So if you've got, with the captive deer industry moving semen around for artificial insemination, is it can you detect it in semen?
Chair Purcell, members of the committee. Yes, if there is a prion, if there is a biological sample or environmental sample that contains prions, we believe that we can selectively target those prions, enrich them using probes or antibodies that will concentrate those prions and then we can perform our test on that enriched sample, whether it be from semen or urine or feces. We can perform our test, an advanced microfluidic nanotechnology assay, and yes, we do believe that we can test in samples of that nature.
Mr. Chair. And you have a strong team here. Is there an equivalent team in soils or in fish and wildlife looking at retention of prions in the environment, translocation of prions up into plants, persistence of prions over time in the natural environment? Is the university looking at that at all?
Chair Purcell, Representative Hansen, I'm unaware of that type of research being conducted.
And, Mr. Chair, and a follow-up, the potential of human contact or human infection has wide-ranging consequences. I've participated in the late deer hunt. I have deer in my freezer. Somebody butchered that. You know, we have processing. We have hundreds, if not thousands, of Minnesotans that butcher deer in their garage or at their cabin. Is there anyone doing research on the retention of prions or the resilience of prions on metal or plastic or in locker plants, in butcher shops, in the human environment? Anyone looking at that?
Chair Purcell, Representative Hansen, I'm quite confident that that was looked at pretty extensively during the whole issue with BSE in the UK. And so I think we could extrapolate from what's been done, but I am not aware of those type of research questions being done surrounding chronic wasting disease.
And then finally, is anyone looking to test the hypothesis of it moving in primates? Do we have any research? Do we have any human health or equivalent or similar simian studies to look at whether it's jumping the boundary right now?
Representative Hansen, Chair Purcell, there is a study in progress that is cited on the CDC website where materials from CWD-infected deer have been fed to certain primate species, and now they are tracking the occurrence of the prion protein in those primates. And that has been presented at a scientific meeting, and you can access that off the CWD website, the presentation. It has not, to my knowledge, been published to date. So we are sort of waiting on the formal conclusions of that study. But they have shown that some of the monkeys fed meat from CWD infected but not clinical deer have the prion protein in their brain.
Chair Purcell and members of the committee, I'd like to have a quick follow-up to that. There was a paper published this past August that does show or provide evidence for CWD prions in culture. So it's important, in culture, cellular culture, to infect and cause human prion proteins to convert to a pathogenic form. I think it's critically important to understand that the causative agent is CWD. It's not just one single monotypic protein. There's actually several strains, and these strains can be different whether they occur in elk or white-tailed deer. And that's very important if you think about if you want to try to understand the evolvability or how the CWD prion might change over time. It's difficult to predict what can happen in 10 years, 20 years, or 50 years down the road. But if we have a greater understanding of that variation of the CWD strains that are circulating in nature, that's going to help us to understand downstream issues like human pathogenicity.
Just real quick here, Dr. Larson, would you be so kind to share that paper and where can the journal can be found?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And in conclusion, I'm more the potential for human impact here, I'm more willing to fund the moonshot on that than on enabling the continuation of the status quo. We're years into this crisis now. It's been a slow-moving, evolving crisis. And I think for Minnesotans, there's three parts to this. There's the domestic animal part, there's the wildlife part, and then there's the human part. And what you're talking about is primarily focusing on the domestic part. I understand the potential there, but if we have deer shedding in the outdoor environment already, if the barn door is already open and they've gone out, then what is that impact on humans, and how do we manage that, and what is the impact on the environment to contain? And I can see the applicability of some of this, but I see two parts here that I would hope in some of the other colleges within the university that we better start looking, or we better start dealing. And for us, we have to deal with the policy side of this. Where do we fund resources, and how do we make management decisions? And so those two pieces, resilience in the environment, if it can translocate from soil into plants, that scares me. If it can make the jump, or if it's already made the jump, that scares me more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be quick. And I don't think, you know, kind of to get back to Representative Heisman's question, comments earlier, it's not so much that I am implying that we shouldn't go forward with this kind of research. I think it's more of a matter, this is the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. And from the natural resource perspective, deer hunters have been paying more than their fair share to manage this disease at the same time that industry is not paying for it. And it's not so much that deer hunters would be against us spending, and you're implying we'd be using legacy dollars or something like that to pay for it. It's more of who's paying and who's benefiting, and is that fair? And so also to that, the focus today has been mostly on, the captive deer. And I'm wondering if you can comment on how we've dealt with other prion diseases in captive animals. And, a two-year, this would be great to be able to do the testing quicker, but 2 years is not how you react to an outbreak or a crisis. So I'm wondering if you have some thoughts on what we've learned from mad cow in, a captive animal prion disease, and how that could be applied right now without waiting.
Gentlemen?
Chair Purcell and Representative, certainly these type of diseases are, and any control programs, are greatly hampered by the inability to do any sort of testing in the living animal. All of the work that we've done I will conclude in a minute with listing some examples of solutions that we have found have surrounded viral and bacterial diseases, where we have been able to develop tests that can be applied in the living animal. And so that makes control programs much quicker and easier to deploy. And maybe while I'm kind of on this topic, to respond to Representative Hanson, if we were going to do anything with soils and plants, it would be essential that we had a way of testing and monitoring what was going on with soils and plants. And so this would be the first step to getting there. So specifically in the case of BSC, this was largely an eradication plan that was put in place, and it was largely driven by epidemiologic studies. So a positive animal and then trace back to the herd, looking at which animals possibly could have had relationship, epidemiologic relationship, and then eliminating those animals. So very much of eradication through destroying all kind of related animals, and then testing of all animals, and then very much gearing up and monitoring everything going through the food supply within the UK at that time. So, you know, certainly the college has been part of response programs in the past, and we were working side by side with the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Natural Resources as we dealt with the high path avian influenza, and we did respond quickly, but we had a test. And we had a rapid test, and we had a rapid test that could turn around results in less than 24 hours. And that makes a huge difference in being able to respond. So the two-year timeline is really on developing a test so that then we are capable of responding. And I would just like to highlight that we do have a history at the college of finding solutions to help the animal populations of the state. When a foreign animal disease was introduced into our swine industry through, we believe, feed that was imported from China, our diagnostic lab was the first diagnostic lab to develop a test that could then be used for control programs in the living animals to eliminate or at least control that disease. Similarly, we have worked to spread other diseases like avian metapneumovirus in 2003 by developing a test and then later developing a vaccine that could help control that disease. If we go back to 1991, our researchers developed the methodology to create a vaccine for porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome, which was at that time a devastating disease in the hog industry, and today remains an important disease that without the vaccine developed at the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Minnesota, we would have a harder time managing that disease. And if we go back to 1949, our college developed the diagnostic test that was used to control and eventually eliminate brucellosis or Bang's disease out of our cattle populations in the United States. So the University of Minnesota is well positioned with its multidisciplinary research teams. You heard about involving the College of Science and Engineering, and there's been requests for us to involve other colleges involving soils and plants. And so certainly the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine would look forward to this opportunity of providing a solution that could possibly help with us as the state deals with this important challenge of chronic wasting disease. And we thank you very much for your time in listening with thank us you. Today.
Real quick, if you can, Representative Becker.
Yep. Just want to clarify real quick on something you said a couple minutes back in your answer. But so are you suggesting we should not react until we have a test? Or... because that's kind of what it sounded like from part of your answer. So just you, real quick. Thank
please.
You, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Chair Purcell, Representative. I'm sorry if that was the way it sounded. What my answer was, I obviously you respond with every tool you have possible at the moment, and then you also look for opportunities to create new tools.
Representative Hynton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name came up earlier, so I just want to quickly respond and make a comment and. I think that what we're hearing today from the university is some of the most positive discussion around CWD that maybe we've had in quite a while. And I brought this up with Chair Hansen last week. I think in the case of the university and CWD, this may be an opportunity very similar to what we've created with the Aquatic Invasive Research Center. Minnesota, I think, should be cutting edge on this issue and working on developing the science to solve these problems. And I know that there's been a number of times, and I don't think it's wrong to bring up the cost element, but I do think that Minnesota should be leading the way on CWD, and I think that's what I'm hearing from hunters more than anything else, is work on this issue, figure out a way to move the needle.
I think we got some agreement. Representative Fabian, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, Dr. Ames, thank you. You mentioned in your opening comments that CWD was present in other countries, I believe. If I heard that incorrectly, I apologize. I know of Canada, but what other countries is CWD?
Some of the Scandinavian countries. I believe it's Finland, Norway, and possibly Sweden. And Korea as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the epidemiology or whatever that term is, I mean, how did it get there? Where did it come from? Do we have some sort of a tracing mechanism?
I don't have a good answer to you on that. I know, if, for example, in Norway, it's in their reindeer population. They have no idea how it got into that reindeer population and are working vigorously to control it.
Our Scandinavian minister is going to be addressing that.
Chair Purcell, transported animals.
Thank you.
We believe transported animals are the source of that.
Yeah, being transported. Very good. And if there's more information on Representative Fabian's question, we'd be happy to receive it on that. So thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you.
And we now have we have another presenter. That's kind of why we're hurrying along here. So Dr. Lee Fralick is going to talk about their forest ecosystems and potential climate change impacts.
Welcome, Dr. Fralick. If you could introduce yourself and get started.
Yes. I am Lee Fralick, and I'm director of the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology. And thank you, the chair and the committee, for this opportunity to inform you about the impacts of climate change on natural resources, although forests are my main expertise, so I will concentrate on that. So Minnesota is really a state that's at the crossroads when it comes to climate change, because we have three biomes in the state. It's a very unique state for that reason. We have the boreal or conifer forests in the north. We have a belt of temperate deciduous, which would be maple and oak and basswood, running through the middle of the state from northwest to southeast, and then we have prairies, used to be native grasses, nowadays mostly corn, but still grasses. And it's one of the two places in the entire world that has this combination of biomes. And because they're all on edge, and all of our native species, but one or two in terms of trees, and most wildlife species are at the edge of their range here, we will be more sensitive to climate change than other places. And so I like to tell people we are the edgiest state in the union when it comes to natural resources. So what determines the difference between the boreal forest and the temperate forest? I'll start with that. And basically, our research has determined that it's due to the mean summer temperature. That would be June, July, and August mean temperature. So when you have a cool summers like they have in northeastern Minnesota, trees like spruce and fir grow more than maple or oak. And there's a tipping point around between 64 and 65 degrees for where they both grow about the same amount. And then if it gets warmer than that, the maples and oaks will outgrow the spruce and fir and therefore replace them. If you look at this from the point of view of being at one place that may have previously had summer temperatures of 63 degrees, and it's progressing to warmer temperatures of 64 and 65, and then in the future to 66. And this is something that would be happening in Ely right now and Duluth. They were in the zone where the boreal trees would grow better than temperate trees. Now they're right at the tipping point, and it will only be another decade or two that they will be on the warm side, where the temperate trees will outgrow the boreal trees and therefore take over, and it will change the boundary of the biome. We've found by looking at hundreds of locations across Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, and upper Michigan, which are kind of the tension zone between these two biomes, that with the warming that has already occurred, the temperate species, maple and oak, are invading boreal forests already. And you see here a picture that I took in the summer of 2016, and there's a sugar maple tree there in this boreal forest of fir and spruce, that, and there were no temperate trees there 40 years ago, and I've been working in this forest all that time. So the invasion is already widespread. We found red maple seedlings on almost every one of our 2,000 plots in the boundary waters. So red maple seedlings are already in the understory. It's already determined that red maple is going to replace the boreal forest with the warming we've already had, which is very small in magnitude compared to what's coming. Looking at the prairie forest border, the balance between that is determined by the water balance, or the precipitation minus evaporation balance. If there's a positive water balance, in other words, more rainfall than evaporation, which shows in the blue and green on the map on the right here, then forests are supported. If it's a negative water balance, more evaporation than precipitation, which are the brown colors here, then we have grasslands. And you see the historic prairie forest border there of Minnesota, which corresponded pretty much with that zero balance between evaporation and precipitation. And the question is, where is that going to move as the climate warms in the future? And we have a variety of scenarios that I'll show in a few minutes, but it's going to shift dramatically to the north and east, possibly as far as Thunder Bay, or maybe even more than that, depending on our trajectory for warming. Another very important factor in forests and how fast they could be converted from one biome type to the other is windstorms. So this map shows the frequency of straight line winds in thunderstorms. You notice the Twin Cities there has the highest frequency. Actually, it's the highest frequency in the world. We get hurricane force gusts almost every summer, but it's sevenfold higher than it is in northern Minnesota. So if that frequency of windstorms migrates to northern Minnesota as the climate warms, the boreal forest will blow down and be converted to temperate forest at quite a rapid rate, because boreal trees are not adapted to high winds, unlike our temperate trees. And, for example, you probably remember the 1999 big blowdown in the boundary waters, which blew down about 40% of all the forest in the boundary waters wilderness, and you see before and after pictures here. So it looks like Paul Bunyan got out his lawnmower here and just mowed the forest flat. But at that time, all the understory was still boreal trees, and so they were released to grow. If you look at a lot of these forests today, there's an understory of maple or oak. This is a picture taken just a few years ago on the North Shore, and it's a boreal forest of birch, aspen, spruce, and fir. And all that red in the understory, those are those maple seedlings that I told you about. So if this forest were to blow down in a windstorm, it would be instantly converted from boreal to temperate, because those seedlings would be released to grow. We also have the earthworm invasion in Minnesota. We don't have any native earthworms here, and what earthworms do for a living is eat dead leaves. We used to have a thick accumulation of dead leaves that could be anywhere from 3 to 6 inches thick. And as the earthworms invade across the state, they eat that, and that is insulation that keeps the soil cool in the summer. And when that goes, soil temperatures go up just from the earthworm effect, and that will be added to the effect of warming soils because of warmer air temperatures. And that's really concerning because the most important place where trees experience temperature and where it matters is in the soil, right? The upper part of the tree can experience a huge range of temperatures, and it, through evolution, is designed to do that. But the roots of trees cannot tolerate a big range of temperature change. So we're expecting a large magnitude of temperature change in the soil that will affect the roots. And you see here an extremely unhappy balsam fir with its root system exposed. And that is because of worms. The forest floor would have been 6 inches deeper here just before the worms invaded. Then we also have increasing deer populations in the far north. We have fairly high populations in the south and central. But in the far north, deer have been limited by climate because of the number of days with deep snow and cold temperatures. That will be less and less limiting in the future. And deer can eat the seedlings of certain species of trees, cedar, yellow birch, red maple, red oak. They can eat the seedlings of a number of trees, and that adds to the stress caused by climate change. It would be hard to overemphasize this point that other changes in the environment act in concert with climate change to change the forest. And then we have droughts increasing in frequency, along with warmer mean temperatures and longer summers. Insect infestations because of lack of extreme cold in the winter. If the only thing climate change did was to get rid of minus 40 in northern Minnesota, that could kill the boreal forest because there are a number of insect species that are killed by those temperatures, and that would then be able to have an outbreak. And they can even be native insects. So I expect a lot of surprises there. And, of course, I already mentioned we'll get more windstorms and more fires, and we have some recent research which is in the process of peer review showing that disturbances of all types are increasing in frequency. The lives of trees is getting shorter, and we believe the common factor there pushing on all of those forest disturbances is a warming climate. Another factor is the extremes in especially spring, these extreme warm spells and extreme cold spells. This is March of 2012, and you might remember that magnolias were in bloom here in March. Well, up around Thunder Bay, the picture on the bottom there is a spruce forest that turned brown over thousands of square miles, and that's because they came out of dormancy too early and were then killed when temperatures returned to normal. So that alone could wipe out in one fell swoop the whole boreal forest from Minnesota all the way out to New Brunswick. So this just shows the multiple drivers of change in the blue ovals, droughts, earthworms, deer, fires, storms, and insect pests and diseases. It's like six gas pedals that the climate pushes on, and then they push on the forest, and then you add to that the direct impacts of temperature on the forest. And that will lead to savannification, and because adult trees are dying more frequently and seedlings are unable to replace them. So if you look at northern Minnesota, these are your boreal species. This whole suite of species is in danger of dying off and not occurring in Minnesota in the future. That includes red pine. You know, we might have to get a new state tree if red pine is to exit the state in a warming climate. And those trees could be replaced by these species, even in the far northern part of the state, things like bur oak and hackberry, elms, basswood, Kentucky coffee tree, species that we have in southeastern Minnesota at this time. If there's forest at all, if it doesn't become grassland, it would be these species. So to put this in pictures, we have this analog technique. So we have the blue star for the boundary waters, and the question is, where is a place which right now has the summer climate that the Boundary Waters will have in several decades under a kind of a moderate warming scenario, and the answer is where the orange star is near Granite Falls, Minnesota. And then we can look at the vegetation in those two places and see what it looks like. Now, here's the Boundary Waters. And you see black spruce here growing on rock, and we did manage to find a place near Granite Falls with the same type of rock, same physiography, same chemistry of the soil. The only difference is a 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit difference in summer temperature, and it makes that difference in the vegetation. So going from that, warm up the summers by 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit, and you get this, and it has oaks and mixed with prairie grasses and prairie forbs, goldenrods and sunflowers and things like that. So this is some of our brand new research based on previous research where we determine what the temperature limits are for boreal versus temperate forest, and the what I mentioned earlier about the precipitation versus evaporation balance for prairies. And on the left, you see a map of the current biome distribution. So in the far northeastern part of the state, you have boreal in the blue, and then mixed boreal and temperate in the light green. The yellow would be temperate broadleaf like maple, oak, and basswood in the prairies way out in the west. Actually a little further west than at the time of European settlement, because the climate has gotten moister, and our models did show that the prairie climate was pushed further to the west in the last few decades, but we expect that to reverse. So for a low CO2 emission scenario, the upper map, the prairies will push a little bit in. The boreal will recede a little bit, but nothing like we would have with a business as usual or high CO2 emission scenario shown in the bottom map, where the prairie would climates would push all the way into the Twin Cities. We would totally lose the boreal biome in Minnesota. The Boundary Waters would be forested with oak and maple, and in the west it would even have some prairies. This is a range of possible scenarios. The high scenario in the last slide was nowhere near the highest possible scenario. So I'm showing a low and a medium and a very high scenario here, and it is possible we would get this scenario where the prairie would push all the way to Duluth by 2070. And the Boundary Waters would be mostly prairie and savanna. It's possible by the year 2100 with a business as usual scenario that the prairie could push all the way to Thunder Bay or even beyond that. So we still have a choice of which of these scenarios we go on depending on CO2 emissions. And of course, when you change the vegetation, you change the wildlife. So wildlife is dependent on vegetation and climate. So lynx, for example, depend on deep, long-duration snow cover each winter, and when that disappears, they would be replaced by bobcats. Moose, of course, would be replaced by another member of the deer family, the white-tailed deer that we just were talking about for the last hour. And there are lots of boreal birds that would be replaced by other species, but I was recently in Ely, and a naturalist there told me red-bellied woodpeckers have already shown up in Ely, and I was really stunned to hear that. So lots of wildlife species would be replaced by other species, and because we're at the southern edge of the range for all those boreal ones, they would be lost to the state. So big changes are coming to the Midwest. With our edges of biomes that we have, we could easily become the new Kansas. We could be a prairie state. I'm not sure why we need to create another Kansas in Minnesota. We already have one Kansas. It seems to me to be enough. The boreal forest for a business as usual scenario is likely to disappear from the region, and that's one-third of all our native species. And that would be every taxonomic group, trees, wildflowers, birds, fungi, insects, any taxonomic group you can name, one-third of them are boreal. There's still time to change that outcome, though, because we still have time to follow a low-emission scenario and not have these big changes. And smaller magnitudes of change are much easier to manage. All right, with the low emission scenario, we could manage that. The high emission scenario, there would be nothing that forest managers could do. If you have 8 degrees Fahrenheit and temperature change, all the forests that we have now are going to die, and you just can't manage that situation. You just have to adapt to what you're forced to adapt to what happens. So thank you, and I would be happy to take any questions that you have if there's time.
I'm thinking about when you're talking about that prairies may move. And it pops in my head, there's old Glacial Lake Aiken and that wetlands over there. And what happened to that?
Yeah, well, shallower wetlands, if we get into an environment with high evaporation relative to precipitation, shallow wetlands will dry up. Even a lot of the shallow lakes, in like the ones in west central Minnesota that tend to be relatively shallow, could easily become wetlands or even totally dry up. Shifting the precipitation evaporation balance not only has grave consequences for forests, but wetlands and lakes as well.
Thank you. Ripken Lippert.
Thank you, Chair. My question is similar. Just as the as precipitation affects where the boundary between the forest and the prairie is, mm-hmm. But then you're saying that. As temperatures rise, that also affects where that boundary is due to evaporation that's happening as well. So that's why in the slide in the high emission scenario that the prairie was extending into the state of Minnesota rather than the forest extending. The precipitation may still be high as we move to higher temperatures, but evaporation would increase as well. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. That's a really good question, and in fact, the warmest scenario that I showed that had the prairie going all the way to Duluth has more precipitation than we have today, substantially more. But the evaporation goes up more than the precipitation. Mm. If the growing season is 8 months long instead of 6 months, and it's much hotter in the middle of summer, you can have much, much higher evaporation. So, I mean, you can find places that are like that. Kansas City, for example, has more precipitation than we do. They average 40 inches per year, and yet it's a drier climate there than what we have.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question. I was fortunate enough to be in the Climate and Energy meeting last week when you came and presented as well, and I think in that meeting there was talk about Minnesota being one of the states in the country that's warming the fastest. And so you talked also about our state being one of two places where we are on the edge of biomes, at the edgiest state areas. And so wondering what the other place is, and can we learn any lessons, or are they experiencing the same rapid change that we are?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, that's a good question. Where is that other area? Well, it's in the middle of Asia, in the Kazakhstan area, where the boreal forest in Siberia is across the north. I mean, some people would say northern Minnesota is Siberia too. But Siberia across the north, the steppes of Asia, which are grasslands, and then there's actually temperate forests coming out of Central Europe, and they all three meet right there. And both locations, Minnesota and that location, are experiencing extremely high rates of climate change because they're both in the center of continents, and central locations that are far from the ocean are changing much faster than areas close to the ocean.
Thank you.
Other question, members? Seeing none, thank you very much, Dr. Braley, for your presentation, and members, we will have this printed and distributed. I apologize, I don't have it at this time, but you'll get it. So.
Okay. All right. You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Without any further business, we stand adjourned.